world. Can you think of a reason why Debbie would have drawn these images? Asked Decker quietly. He pointed first to the cami figure, and then the heart. Was she seeing anyone? He added. The heart seemed to indicate this was a possibility. Even in the 21st century, a heart drawn by a young woman next to the image of a man probably meant exactly what it had always meant throughout time. George Watson shook his head, his mustache trembling along with the rest of him. His stunted arms swung next to his torso. Decker wondered how many jibes the man had endured over his life for his unusual appendage. That abnormality had probably defined everything about him, not because it should, but because sometimes the world and the people in it could be so cruel. Beth Watson didn't shake her head. She nodded slightly, and both Decker and Lancaster immediately focused on her.
Who were they?
Asked Lancaster.
Never knew,
said Beth haltingly.
I mean, she never brought anyone home that we didn't know.
We're interested in anyone she might have brought home, said Decker.
No, I mean, those were boys. You said this person was big. The paper said 6'2". Couple hundred pounds or more, Debbie never brought anyone home bigger than her father.
George cleared his throat and said ruefully, I'm not even 5'8". Had my first growth spurt in 10th grade and never had another. Then he fell silent, looking perplexed and a bit appalled that he had bothered to offer up triviality in the face of such tragedy.
And they were all boys from school,
said Beth.
One of them's dead, too, in fact, like my poor Debbie. Which one?
Asked Lancaster, her pen poised over her pad.
Jimmy Schickel. Nice kid, played on the football team, very popular. We've known them for years. Debbie and Jimmy went to elementary school together. He took Debbie to the junior prom, but they were just friends.
She bowed her head and said,
You just can't imagine what it's like to lose your child.
She picked up a paper towel off the coffee table and dabbed at her eyes while her husband awkwardly rubbed her shoulder. At the woman's words, Lancaster had shot Decker a glance, but he didn't return it. He kept his gaze on Beth. He knew exactly what it was like to lose a child, and that fact wouldn't matter in the least in this circumstance. There could be no commiseration among such people despite the seeming commonality of loss, because it was actually each parent's totally unique hell. But there was someone else? Prompted Decker. Someone you didn't know, but that Debbie also didn't bring here? That's what you mean, right? Beth balled up the paper towel and dropped it on the carpet. Her husband picked it up and placed it on the coffee table. She flicked him an annoyed look, and in observing that, Decker wondered how bad the marriage was. Just the little paper cuts that added up over the long term and that most unions survived? Or was it more than that? Enough to bring them to the point where losing Debbie might become the irreparable crack? Then again, it could cause them to circle the wagons. He had seen that happen, too.
She'd post stuff online about him, but she never talked directly about him. Even so, I picked up the signs here and there. A mom just does.
So you read the online posts?
I had her password for a while. When she found out, she changed it. She never named him, but she did have a pet name for him. What was that?
Asked Lancaster.
Jesus. How do you know that? Was it in one of the posts? No. I saw it on the chalkboard that's in her room. She had done some little poem about Jesus. Debbie wasn't religious. I mean, we don't go to church or anything, so it wasn't that. It was a guy. The poem was a little personal. It was definitely about a guy. When I went to ask her about it, she ran to her room and erased it.
Decker and Lancaster exchanged a glance. He said, But do you know if it was biblical or a Latino reference? When she looked at him puzzled, he added, I mean, Jesus or Jesus.
Oh, well, hell, I never thought about that. I just thought she had some sort of God complex with the guy. But I don't think my Debbie would have been hanging out with some Jesus Mexican.
She added in an offended tone. She wiped her nose and smoked a cigarette.
I mean, moms always know, even if their daughters don't believe they can know stuff. Debbie certainly thought we were clueless.
She gave a sideways glance at her husband.
And some are clueless, really clueless.
Hubby removed his hand from her shoulder and dropped it between his legs, like a dog doing the same with its tail. He might have trousers on, thought Decker, but he clearly didn't wear the pants in the family. Decker flicked a glance at Lancaster. Online posts? She nodded.
We'll get all of it.
So she never said anything about this person? Nothing?
I asked more than once, but she didn't bite.
She paused.
Well, she did slip and say that I wouldn't understand him. He was so mature.
Meaning older. Not in high school, said Decker.
That's what I took it to mean, yes. I mean, she was a senior. She sure as hell wasn't talking about any of her classmates, and she didn't bother with the juniors. And Debbie was a real looker, all developed and everything. Lots of boys had their eyes on her. I tried to give her advice, but girls don't listen. I didn't listen when my mom tried to tell me. I always went for the bad boys.
Her husband looked at the detectives almost apologetically. And then she married me.
Had to marry you, George. We had Debbie on the way. My mother almost had a heart attack anyway. By far the best thing to come out of our marriage was Debbie. And now I don't even have her, which means I got nothing.
Lancaster looked away at this, and George Watson bit down on his lip and decided to focus on an old water ring mark on the coffee table. Decker studied the pair of them. In the wake of such tragedy, all other societal rules within a marriage tended to give way. What was never spoken about was now easily and readily revealed. It was as though the dam holding it all back had failed. Debbie might have been the dam, and now her death represented the breach.
Why the sketch of the cami gear?
Asked Lancaster. She looked at George.
Do you hunt? Do you have camouflage gear here?
He shook his head forcefully. I couldn't shoot an animal. I don't even own a gun. Decker said, I guess your condition would make it difficult to hold the weapon properly. George looked down at his malformed arm. I was born with it. He paused. It's made lots of things difficult, he added resignedly. So the cami gear might be a reference to this guy Jesus, said Decker. It might be, said George cautiously.
It had to be,
snapped Beth.
She had a heart next to it.
She glanced at Lancaster with a knowing, exasperated look.
Guys don't get it, do they? Never set foot in a damn Hallmark store.
Decker said, I saw the laptop on the kitchen counter. Did Debbie use that?
No, she had her own. It's in her room.
Can we take a look at her room now? They were led down the hall by Beth. Before she turned away, she took a last drag on her smoke and said,
however this comes out, there is no way my baby would have had anything to do with something like this, drawing of this asshole or not. No way. Do you hear me? Both of you.
Loud and clear, said Decker. But he thought if Debbie were involved, she had already paid the ultimate price anyway. The state couldn't exactly kill her again. Beth casually flicked the cigarette down the hall, where it sparked and then died out on the faded runner. Then she walked off. They opened the door and went into Debbie's room. Decker stood in the middle of the tiny space and looked around. Lancaster said,
we'll have the tech guys go through her online stuff. Photos on her phone, her laptop over there, the cloud, whatever. Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, wherever else the kids do their electronic preening. Keeps changing, but our guys will know where to look.
Decker didn't answer her. He just kept looking around, taking the room in, fitting things in little niches in his memory, and then pulling them back out if something didn't seem right as weighed against something else.
I just see a typical teenage girl's room, but what do you see?
Asked Lancaster finally. He didn't look at her, but said, Same things you're seeing. Give me a minute. Decker walked around the small space, looked under piles of papers in the young woman's closet, knelt down to see under her bed, scrutinized the wall art that hung everywhere, including a whole section of People magazine covers. She also had chalkboard squares affixed to one wall. On them was a musical score and short snatches of poetry and personal messages to herself. Deb, wake up each day with something to prove.
Pretty busy room,
noted Lancaster, who had perched on the edge of the girl's desk.
We'll have forensics come and bag it all.
She looked at Decker, obviously waiting for him to react to this, but instead, he walked out of the room.
Decker!
I'll be back, he called over his shoulder. She watched him go and then muttered,
Of all the partners I could have had, I got Rain Man, only giant size.
She pulled a stick of gum out of her bag, unwrapped it, and popped it into her mouth. Over the next several minutes, she strolled the room, and then came to the mirror on the back of the closet door. She appraised her appearance and ended it with the resigned sigh of a person who knows their best days physically are well in the past. She automatically reached for her smokes, but then decided against it. Debbie's room could be part of a criminal investigation. Her ash and smoke could only taint that investigation. She whirled around when Decker came back into the room.
Where'd you go?
I had some questions for the parents, and I wanted to take a look around the rest of the house.
And?
He walked over to the musical score written on the chalkboard wall and pointed to it. Debbie didn't do this. Lancaster gazed at the symbols.
How do you know that?
She doesn't play an instrument. I checked her school record earlier. She's never been in the band. I asked her mother. She's never played an instrument, and there are none in the house. Second, there are no sheets of music in this room. Even if you didn't play an instrument and just composed music, I think you'd have some sheet music or, more likely, blank score sheets in your room. Third, that's not Debbie's handwriting. Lancaster drew closer to the wall and studied the marks there and then compared them with the other writing on the wall.
But how can you really tell? I mean, musical scores aren't like other writing. They're symbols, not letters.
Because Debbie is right-handed. Whoever wrote this was left-handed. Even though it's not letters, you can still tell by the sweeps, flourishes, and general flow of the marks. He picked up some chalk and wrote on a different section of the board some of the musical symbols. I'm right-handed, and you can see the difference. He pointed to some smudges on the board. And that's where the person's left sleeve smeared some of the score. For a righty, it would be in the opposite place. Like mine. He pointed to where his sleeve had brushed against some of the chalk marks. And Leopold is right-handed.
How do you know that?
He signed a paper I gave him when I saw him in his prison cell.
Okay, but maybe a friend of hers who is a musician did it.
But Decker was already shaking his head. No.
Why not? I could see a buddy of hers writing out a tune or something on here. Maybe inspirational, to match some of Debbie's writing.
Because those notes make no sense at all. You couldn't play it with any instrument of which I'm aware. From a music composition perspective, it's gibberish.
How do you know? Did you play music?
Decker nodded. In high school, guitar and drums. I know my way around scores, and not just the ones on the football field. Lancaster glanced back at the symbols.
So what is it, then?
I think it's a code, said Decker. And if I'm right about that, it means Jesus was in this house. Chapter 22 Decker and Lancaster had sealed off Debbie's bedroom and called in the forensics team, which had gone over the room and the house in meticulous detail. Burlington had never suffered a crime such as this one, and everyone, from the rookie on the team to the most senior departmental official, was bringing his A game. The Watsons said they knew nothing of the musical score. Decker tended to believe them. After the forensics teams finished, Decker and Lancaster sat down with the Watsons once more. If the guy came to this house to write the score on the wall, could he do so without your knowledge? Decker asked him.
Well, we do have to sleep,
said a defensive Beth.
But the house isn't that big, and our room is right next to Debbie's. George and I are both light sleepers. I don't see how she could have had a guy in her room and we not know about it. What about during the day?
Said Lancaster.
I'm a stay-at-home mom. George is a 9-to-5er. I'm here a lot more than Debbie, actually.
How long ago do you remember seeing the musical score on the chalkboard? Asked Decker.
It wasn't there 2 weeks ago, I can tell you that,
she replied. How do you know that? Asked Decker.
Because I wiped the whole thing clean.
She paused.
We'd had an argument, and I just, well, I lost it and wiped all that crap off.
She let out a little sob.
And now I'll never see her again.
Argument about what? Asked Decker, ignoring her distress. He needed answers, and he needed them now. She could grieve later. Beth composed herself.
Debbie was a senior. She took the SAT and did okay, but she hadn't applied to one damn college. She made excuses about cost, and it's true that we can't really help her out, but I kept telling her there's financial aid out there, and without a degree, what was she going to do, be me?
She paused again as her husband looked away.
So I lost it and wiped her damn board clean. All those messages she had on there about changing the world and having a purpose, it was bullshit. She was doing nothing and going nowhere, so I wiped it clean. Clean slate. Hoped she'd get the point. Guess she didn't. Guess she never will now. Not now. Oh, shit, my baby. My baby.
Beth dissolved into tears and started writhing uncontrollably on the couch. With Decker's help, her husband managed to get her into the bedroom to lie down. Decker could hear her calling out to her dead daughter the whole way as he walked back down the hall to join Lancaster. George Watson came back out a few minutes later and said, "I think we're done for now, if that's all right." Decker said, "Have you and your wife gone away on a trip recently?" George looked at him in some amazement. "How'd you know that?" "The guy came here and wrote what he wrote. And if you had been here, you probably would have seen him. And he wouldn't take that kind of chance." "So you were gone at some point?" "A week ago, we drove to Indiana to be with Beth's sister. She was ill. We were there 2 days and then drove back." "And Debbie stayed here?" "Yes, we couldn't take her out of school." "So that's probably when he came," said Decker. George began to shake, wrapping his arms around himself. "Do you really think that animal was in our house? In our daughter's bedroom?" Decker gave the man with the wrecked arm the one silver. "I think it's highly possible, yes." Lancaster gave Decker a fierce stare and said quickly,
"Well, thanks for your help, Mr. Watson. We'll be going now, and we're very sorry for your loss."
George walked him to the door. As he opened it, he said, "Debbie wouldn't have helped anyone kill people at Mansfield. They were her friends." "I can appreciate that," said Decker. "I hope it turns out you're right." George blinked rapidly, as though he had never considered that he might be wrong. He shut the door behind them. Decker and Lancaster walked down the sidewalk.
"Your bedside manner is as terrific as always,"
said Lancaster sarcastically. "I'm not here to be his friend and hold his hand, Mary. I'm here to catch whoever killed his daughter."
"Okay, okay. I got an email from forensics. They found nothing pertinent on Debbie's phone or laptop. No photos, emails, texts, voicemails. And there are no online postings on any site they could think of or which Debbie had access to. Her mom said she had seen some alluding to this guy, but Debbie must have deleted them. But maybe our guys can still dig them up somehow.
This guy would never have let her take his picture. No electronic trails, either. Far too easy. Our guy may not even have web access.
How do you figure?
I'm seeing someone outside the mainstream. No ties. A loner. He floats from place to place.
Based on what? Something you saw?
No. Something I felt. But one thing has me puzzled.
Just one? You're lucky, then.
She said, smiling grimly.
My list is 6 pages long.
He went on as though he hadn't heard her. Why Debbie? Why pick her to team with?
Team with? What exactly did she do? I thought she was just his girlfriend.
She gave him something he needed.
Something he needed? At the school? You don't mean the guns. There's no way she's lugging in a pistol and a shotgun.
I don't necessarily mean the guns, no.
But why would he need her to bring him anything?
That's what's puzzling me, too. Why her, and why the meeting at the school on that day?
Whoa, Decker, you're pulling way ahead of me. What meeting?
She pretended to be sick. She got out of class, met this guy, probably gave him something, and then he killed her. But there's a time gap that I can't figure right now. She asked him another question, only Decker wasn't listening. His gaze was moving down the street to his left. It was dark, the night air chilly with mist rising from both their mouths as they exhaled. There seemed to be nothing good out in that blackness. But to Decker, the night was suddenly full of threes, his least favorite number. It had first happened when he was a rookie cop. Thankfully, he'd been out on patrol alone. He'd been sitting in his squad car, sipping coffee, when out of the darkness came movement. At first, he thought it was some people trying to sneak up on him. Back then, Burlington had a big gang problem, mostly consisting of young men with no jobs and no hope, too much testosterone, and access to too many guns. He'd thrown his coffee out the window. His hand had gone to his gun, and his other hand to his radio. He'd been about to step out of the vehicle and give a warning to whoever was out there. That's when the figures appeared clearly in front of him. Giant, towering number threes. It was like he'd been suddenly propelled into a bad sci-fi novel. He thought he was going mad, but something coalesced in the middle of his brain. A small scrap of memory from one of the doctors at the Institute outside Chicago, where he'd gone after his injury, and all the weird things had started happening to him. The doctor had said, "Amos, for you, a new day can mean new things. The brain never stops. It is relentless. It is constantly configuring and reconfiguring. I'm trying to tell you that what has happened to you so far may not be the only change you experience with your mind. Tomorrow, next month, next year, a decade hence, you may wake up and discover it is doing something else. There is no way for us to predict it, unfortunately, and it may be terrifying when it does happen. But just know that it's your mind. It's just all in your head. It's not real." With that remembrance, Decker turned back to face the army of numbers, his initial fear receding, but it was replaced with a fresh one. What new stuff will tomorrow bring? He had gotten off duty, gone home, dropped into bed, and wept quietly so that he wouldn't awaken Cassie. In the morning, he told her what had happened. She was predictably supportive and encouraging, and Decker was predictably upbeat, blowing it off as something that was actually funny. But it wasn't funny. It wasn't funny at all. The threes had been gone for a while. In fact, he hadn't seen them coming out of the darkness since Cassie and Molly died. But now they were back. Wonderful. And the threes had added a new dimension. A trio of knives was coming off each of the digit stems. No, not funny at all. "Let me know if they crack the code," he said, as the threes charged forward, knives at the ready. Then he turned, left, and headed down the street.
"Don't you want to ride home?"
asked Lancaster. Decker kept walking, his hand shoved deeply into his coat pockets. He didn't need a ride. He needed to think. He looked at his feet to avoid staring into the faces of the legions of numbers coming at him from out of the gloom. What did Debbie Watson have that their shooter needed? Guns? No. Cami gear? Maybe. But why couldn't he have brought that on his own? He didn't need her for that. The heart and the picture. She was in love. She had a crush on the guy. Would do anything for him. But would she sacrifice her classmates? The picture of the Cami man had not included any weapons. Had Debbie not known what the actual plan was to be? So why had she come out of her classroom to meet the guy? He lifted his eyes, saw the threes flying head-on at him, and lowered his gaze once more. When he had done stakeouts or pull shifts at night, he had worn special glasses that tinted the darkness into a golden color. Gold for him was a sky full of geese. No threes to bother him. He had lost the glasses a long time ago. Now the threes were back, and they were armed. He would need to get new glasses. He stopped walking, leaned against the tree, closed his eyes, dialed up his mental DVR, and replayed everything he had seen at the Watsons' house. The spool unwound in his head, and then he slowed the pace of the mental frames. And then he stopped his DVR, and a row of images stared at him like figurines on a fireplace mantle. Actually, the image was quite literal. They were on the fireplace mantle. Decker turned around and walked quickly back to the Watsons' house. He knocked, and George answered. "Did you forget something?" George asked, sounding a little annoyed. "Pictures on the mantle. I saw them earlier. Can you walk me through them?" "Pictures on the mantle?" said George with a perplexed look. "Walk you through them?" Decker stepped inside the house, forcing the much smaller man to step back quickly. "I'm assuming they're family members." "Yes. What does that have to do with anything?" "I've worked cases long enough to know that it's the one thing you let pass that ends up holding the answer you need. We can't afford any lapses here, Mr. Watson. I'm sure you can understand that. If we're going to find whoever killed Debbie and the others..." What can a man say to that, other than agree? Watson slowly nodded, though he still looked unconvinced. "Okay, sure. Follow me." He led Decker into the small living room and over to the mantel that topped an old brick fireplace that had mortar leaching from the seams.
"Where do you want to start?"
Decker pointed to a picture on the far left, with him.
"Okay, that was my wife's father, Ted Knowles. He died about 2 years ago, heart attack."
"What did he do for a living?"
"What the hell does that have to—" Decker cut him off.
"Just tell me what he did for a living." Decker looked menacingly down at the smaller man. He was a grizzly against the chipmunk, which was exactly how he wanted Watson to see it. Watson took a step back, changed color, and looked at the photo.
"He was a long-haul trucker. Bad diet, no exercise. He was as big as a house when he collapsed on his front lawn picking up the newspaper. He was dead before he hit the grass."
He eyed Decker's massive frame when he said this.
"But that's all he did. He drove a truck back and forth across the Midwest and down to Texas and back."
"Was he close to Debbie?" Watson self-consciously rubbed at his malformed arm.
"No, not really. I mean, we saw them at holidays. But to tell the truth, things weren't good between us and them. My mother-in-law never warmed to me."
"And the man next to him? That picture looks pretty old."
"That's my grandfather, Simon Watson. He's been gone, oh, good 6 years. He was a young man in that picture."
"So Debbie's great-grandfather," said Decker, and Watson nodded.
"He lived over 90 years old, smoked and drank and didn't give a damn, as he liked to say."
"But Debbie knew him, if he's only been gone 6 years?"
"Oh, yes. In fact, he lived with us for the last 5 years of his life."
"So she would have spent time with him?"
"I'm sure she did. Debbie was still a kid then, and Gramps had a pretty interesting life, fought in World War II and then the Korean War. Then he left the service and went to work for the civilian side of the Defense Department.
Doing what?
Well, he worked at the military base here when it was open.
The one next to Mansfield High School?
McDonnell Army Base? That's right.
What did he do there?
He had a series of jobs. His training was in engineering and construction, so he worked on the facilities and plant side.
Do you know the dates?
Come on, what does this have to do with anything?
I'm just looking for leads, Mr. Watson. The dates.
I can't tell you for certain.
He paused and thought about it.
He left the regular army in the 60s. Then he went to McDonnell, probably around 1968 or 69. Must have been 69. I remember associating it with the astronauts walking on the moon. Then he worked there until he retired, about 20 years later.
And the base closed 8 years ago.
That sounds about right.
That wasn't a question, Mr. Watson. It did close 8 years ago on a Monday. There was sleet that day. Watson looked at him strangely and then coughed.
If you say so, I can't remember what I was doing last week. Anyway, it was part of a Pentagon base realignment and Burlington lost out. I heard tell most of the operations moved east, maybe to Virginia, closer to Uncle Sam and his dollars in D.C.
So, presumably Simon talked about his work at the base with you, with Debbie.
Oh, yes. I mean, the parts he could talk about. Some of it was classified, I guess you'd call it.
Classified?
George's features eased to a grin.
Well, I don't think they did nukes or anything there, but the military always has its share of secrets.
So what did Simon talk to you about? I mean, with the base.
Some of the history of it, people he met, some of the work he did. They kept adding on to the base for years, building, building, building. All the people who worked there sent their kids to Mansfield for high school. His son, my father, went there. So did I. So did my wife, for that matter.
Did Debbie ever mention to you some of the things she and her great-grandfather talked about?
Nothing that I really recall. As Debbie got older, she didn't spend as much time with him. Old people, young kids, oil and water. Gramps wasn't as much fun, I guess.
He looked down.
And I guess neither was I.
Okay, take me through the other pictures. A half hour later, Decker was on his way through the dark streets once more. Cammy Man had gone to the Watsons' house and written on that wall in code disguised as a musical score. That he was sure of. He didn't know what the message said, and he didn't know what the man had needed from Debbie. Yet out of all the students at Mansfield, why ally herself with him? There must be a reason, a good one. His phone buzzed. It was Lancaster.
The Bureau thinks they broke the code. It was some sort of substitution cipher. Pretty simple, actually. Well, actually, they're certain they did crack it.
How can they be certain they did?
Because of what the message said.
Don't keep me in suspense, Mary. What did it say?
He heard her release a long breath that seemed filled with apprehension.
It said, "Good job, Amos, but in the end, it won't get you where you want to go, bro."
Chapter 23. I'm an acquired savant. More precisely, I'm a high-functioning, acquired savant. Decker was lying in his bed in his one-room home at the Residence Inn. He was not sleeping. He could not sleep. Orlando Sorrell. Orlando Sorrell was also an acquired savant, having been hit on the head by a baseball when he was 10. Ever since, he had come to possess extraordinary abilities in calendrical calculations, precise memories of weather on any particular day, as well as the near-total recall of where he was and what he was doing on any given day. Daniel Tammet.
Daniel Tammet had suffered a series of epileptic seizures as a small child. He came out of that nearly fatal experience with one of the greatest minds of this century, able to recite Pi out to over 22,000 places and learn entire languages in a week. He had been diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, and also saw numbers and other things in color, as Dekker did. Dekker had studied everything he could find about savants who had not been born with their abilities, but had acquired them after some event, whether an injury, in Sorel's case, or a prior medical condition, in Tammet's. There weren't many savants in the world, and Dekker had been totally unprepared to join their ranks. When LaCroix leveled him on that football field, the doctors, who had extensively examined him, later came away with the conclusion that the injury had done two things to his brain. First, it had opened up channels in his mind, like unclogging a drain, which allowed information to flow far more efficiently. Second, it had caused other circuitry in his mind to intersect, providing him the ability to see numbers in color. But this was only speculation. Dekker had come to believe that doctors today knew only a bit more about how the brain really worked than doctors 100 years ago. Dekker had woken up in the hospital after the hit and looked over at his vitals monitor with all the numbers skipping across it. He had seen his heart rate, 95, the same number on his football jersey, represented as violet for the 9 and brown for the 5. Before his injury, he didn't even know what the color violet was, and the numbers had swelled huge in his head, tall and massive. He could see every detail of them. They were like living things. He remembered sitting up in bed, the sweat pouring off him. He thought he was going insane. He had rung the nurse's bell. A doctor was called, and Dekker had stammered out what he was experiencing. Specialists were called in. Many months later, and after his lengthy stint at the research facility outside Chicago, the consensus was that he was now officially an acquired savant, with hypothymesia and synesthesia abilities. The injury on the field had ended forever his football career, but had given him one of the most exceptional brains in the world. All these years later, he recalled the names and backgrounds of every doctor, nurse, scientist, technician, and other practitioner who had seen him, and there were over 100 of them. He could have been written up in scholarly journals, and there could have been a great deal of media attention surrounding what had happened to him, the odds being somewhere around 1 in a billion. But he had not allowed any of that to happen. He had not seen himself as a prodigy. He had seen himself as a freak. For 22 years of his life, he had been one sort of person. He had been ill-prepared in the span of a few minutes to involuntarily become someone else entirely, to become the person he would one day die as. It was like a stranger had stepped into his body and taken it over, and he could do nothing to get him out. A squatter for life is inhabiting my mind, and he happens to be me. For every action, there was an equal and opposite reaction. Well, in his case, the outgoing, gregarious, prankish, but driven young football player had become reserved, withdrawn, and socially awkward. He no longer related to the great many things that human beings spend a good deal of time over. Small talk, little white lies, emotionally nuanced venting, gossip. He could not understand sympathy or empathy. He was not concerned with others' feelings, their pain and their grief. It was like these things bounced off his new and improved brain, never making a dent. By making him much smarter, the hit had robbed him of the things that made everyone human. It was as though that was the payment demanded. He'd had no choice in accepting or not. He did not even care to watch sports anymore. He had not seen a football game since his injury. Marion Cassie had really saved him. She knew his secret. She shared his anxieties. Without her, Dekker doubted he could have turned his life around, found a new career as a policeman, and then thrived as a detective, turning to the pursuit of justice his new and vastly improved mind.
And though he had never been able to be as affectionate with Cassie as he would have before the hit, he cared for her deeply. He would have done anything for her. They even laughed about his inability to connect more as a human than as a machine. But Decker knew that both of them wished he could. Whenever he held his daughter, Decker could think of nothing but her, as though his monster of a mind was mesmerized by this little person who liked to cuddle with her huge father, a bear and its cub. He would stroke her hair and rub her cheek, and though the recollection was fuzzy, like watching an old TV with a coat hanger for an antenna, it was like he could remember being what he used to be more vividly than at any other time. It was as though his new mind had allowed an exception for these two people, enabling him to be a bit closer to what he once was, but only for those two. Now he was alone, and just the machine forevermore. And he had some prick taunting him, some sick monster who had killed his family and then turned his sights on Mansfield High School. And if the graffiti on the wall of his house had not convinced him, the coded message had put all doubt to rest. The shooters were one and the same, and his family had died because of him. He had known all along that this was possible, even probable. But that little bit of uncertainty had actually been a good thing, allowing him to believe there was a chance that he had not been the motive in their slaughter. Now the uncertainty was gone, and with absolute clarity came terrible, demoralizing resignation, and a sense of guilt that had hit him harder than even Dwayne LaCroix had. At 5 a.m. he rose, showered, dressed in his suit, and stood in front of the small mirror in a bathroom that was about the same size as he was. In the reflection he saw pops of light and colors, numbers soaring across the glass. He closed his eyes, and the picture did not change. It was not on the glass, it was all inside his head. It was said that savants, particularly those diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, were drawn to very narrow slices of interest, numbers, history, a certain field of science or languages. Decker did not know what his narrow slice was supposed to be. He didn't know if the hit by LaCroix had given him Asperger's. He didn't know if that was even possible. And he had never been officially diagnosed with the condition. All he knew was that he could never forget anything. His mind attached colors to things that were not supposed to have them. He could remember what day of the week a particular date in the last 100 years fell on. His mind was a puzzle all put together, but somehow still jumbled, because he understood none of it. It was just who he was now, and it had scared the hell out of him from day one. Yet with Cassie next to him, he had managed it. Without her, without Molly, who had given him something to think about beyond his own lifetime, Amos Decker had become once more a freak, a Jekyll and Hyde. Only Jekyll was gone and would not be coming back. The army of threes awaited him as he trudged through the darkness for the breakfast buffet that opened at 6 on the dot. He collected his plate brimming with food and went to his little table/office and then just sat there staring at the mounds of stuff on his plate and not electing to eat a single bite. June, the buffet attendant, hurried up to him.
"Amos, are you okay?"
she said, her old face creased with some concern. He had never failed to devour his food. When he said nothing, she held up a pot of coffee.
"Can I pour you a cup? Lots of problems get solved by a hot cup of coffee."
Taking his silence for assent, she poured the steaming coffee into a cup, left it on his table, and walked away. Decker had not acknowledged her because he had not even been aware she was there. His mind was a long way from the restaurant at the Residence Inn. He didn't need to look at his watch. It was now 6:23. A part of his mind kept his internal clock at all times, a better timekeeper than anything he could buy.
At 10 o'clock, Sebastian Leopold would be arraigned, this time with counsel attached. Decker intended to be there. He walked. He preferred to walk, even in the dark. The army of threes was there, so he kept his head tilted downward. Decker had read that other savants felt comforted by the oceans and skies of numbers that routinely enveloped them. To Decker, numbers represented a means to an end. They gave him no real happiness. Perhaps because he had experienced happiness in being a husband and father, numbers simply could not compete with that, even for a savant. He sat on a bench outside the courthouse and watched the sun drift into the sky, the dawn breaking and wreaking havoc with the black, smearing it with tendrils of red, gold, and pink. Orrin Decker's mind, a slew of related numbers. At 9:45, he watched the police van pull into the side alley of the courthouse. The prison transport had arrived. He wondered how many other defendants had ridden across with Leopold, or whether the alleged triple murderer had come alone. Decker heaved himself to his feet and walked slowly across the street to the courthouse entrance. A few minutes later, he was seated in the second row. He noted the PD sitting at the counsel table going over the file. The guy looked to be in his early 40s, with gray just starting to creep into his hair. His brown two-piece suit was nicely tailored and had a colorful pocket square. The guy looked confident and, well, veteran. Decker doubted anyone wanted a rookie on this case. The same bailiff stood next to the door to the judge's chambers, chatting with Sheila Lynch, who seemed to be wearing the same black dress from yesterday. Decker heard the door to the courtroom open and turned to look. It wasn't Lancaster or Miller. It was Alex Jameson, the reporter. She saw Decker, nodded, smiled, and then took a seat near the back. Decker turned back around without acknowledging her. The bailiff had disappeared into the judge's chambers. Lynch had gone back over to the counsel table, spoken a few words with the PD, and then taken her seat. The door through which prisoners were led opened, and there was Sebastian Leopold, looking much as he had yesterday. He was escorted over to his lawyer, the shackles were removed, and the officers stepped back. The bailiff opened the door, made his announcement, everyone rose, and Abernathy stepped through and took his seat behind the bench. He took a moment to look over the courtroom and smiled in a satisfied way when he saw the lawyer sitting next to Leopold. Then he eyed Lynch.
"Has the psych evaluation been completed?"
"It had," Lynch told him. "And it stated that Leopold was fit to stand trial." This surprised Decker.
"Mr. Leopold, how do you plead?"
His attorney gripped his client's arm, and together they stood.
"I plead not guilty," said Leopold firmly.
Decker listened to this statement, who did not seem to be able to process it. His attorney said,
"Your Honor, I move that all charges against my client be dismissed. The state has no evidence of his involvement in the three murders."
Lynch jumped to her feet.
"You mean other than his confession?"
The PD said smoothly,
"A confession that he is now recanting. Mr. Leopold is bipolar, went off his medications, which resulted in some unfortunate emotional distress. He is now back on his meds, and his reason has returned, hence his passing the psych exam."
The lawyer held up some documents stapled together.
"And then there's this. Permission to approach?"
Abernathy waved him forward. Lynch hurried after opposing counsel. The PD said in a voice loud enough for Decker to hear,
"This is an authenticated arrest report, complete with mugshot and fingerprints, showing conclusively that Mr. Leopold was in a lockup in Cranston, two towns over from here, on the night the murders in question were committed. I also have a copy of Mr. Leopold's arrest record from Burlington. They've been independently evaluated, and the picture and the prints match perfectly. It is undoubtedly him, as I'm sure Ms. Lynch will agree."
Lynch said furiously,
"Your Honor, defense counsel did not share this with me."
Abernathy looked at her with disdain. You can pull an arrest record faster than defense counsel can, Miss Lynch. If he found it, you should have it, too. Lynch flushed.
What was he arrested for?
She said in a snarky tone. Vagrancy, said the PD. He was released the following morning. Cranston is 70 miles from here, and Mr. Leopold has no means of transportation. But more to the point, the police report shows that Mr. Leopold was arrested at 6 in the afternoon and released at 9 the next morning. Thus, he could not have committed the murders, which occurred around midnight. He handed the papers across to Lynch, who looked down at them, her spirits and confidence ebbing completely away as she reached the bottom of the last page.
He could have had an accomplice,
she said weakly. Well, if you can prove that, more power to you, said the PD. But so far you haven't proven anything. My client went off his meds and involuntarily lied about committing a crime he could not have committed. That is your entire case in a nutshell, which means you have no case.
We can charge him with wasting police time, obstruction of justice.
As I said, he was off his meds. He could not form the intent necessary for either of those two crimes.
Lynch said,
I believe that given time...
Abernathy cut her off. Do you have any evidence other than the recanted confession tying the defendant to the crimes alleged against him? Obviously flustered, Lynch said,
Your Honor, the defendant turned himself into the police and confessed to the crime. Thus, we have not attempted to build a forensic case against him.
Did he sign the confession?
Yes,
she said firmly. Did it include details that only the actual perpetrator of this crime would know? Lynch was again caught off guard.
I don't believe so, no. I'm sure that additional questioning was going to take place, but...
Interrupting, Abernathy said, So, with the confession off the table, you have no evidence?
No.
Lynch admitted, her anger evident but restrained. And now we know for certain that Mr. Leopold was 70 miles away in jail when the murders were committed. Yes, we do, said the PD, barely able to hide a smile. Please step back, said Abernathy pleasantly. The counsels returned to their respective corners. Abernathy peered down from the bench.
The charges against the defendant Sebastian Leopold are dismissed without prejudice. Mr. Leopold, you are free to go. And stay on your meds.
He smacked his gavel. His lawyer turned to Leopold to shake his hand, but Leopold was looking around the courtroom as though he was still unsure of where he was. When his gaze fell on Decker, he smiled weakly and gave a tiny, shy wave. Decker didn't smile or wave back as the officers took Leopold out of the room. As Abernathy disappeared back into chambers, Decker watched as Lynch and the PD exchanged sharp words. Then Decker rose and headed out of the courtroom. Alex Jameson walked out with him.
Did Leopold wave to you, Mr. Decker?
She asked, her tone curious, and in its undertones, a trace of suspicion seemed to percolate. I don't know what he did.
Have you met him before?
Decker kept walking. She called after him.
People would like to hear your side of things.
He turned and walked back to her. My side of things on what?
Do you know Leopold? Because I think he made eye contact with you. He smiled and waved. You were the only one sitting there.
I don't know him.
But you two did talk before, didn't you? In his prison cell?
Decker made the connection instantly. Brimmer. This was her way of getting back at him for juking her at the jail. She had leaked his meeting with Leopold to Jameson.
Why did you meet with the man accused of killing your family?
Decker turned and walked away. And this time, he kept going. Chapter 24. Decker had taken a bus directly over because he didn't want to miss the man.
As he waited, he watched folks walking and driving past. Burlington had a deeply wounded look to it, as though an evil had stolen into town and taken its most valuable possessions, which was exactly what had happened. 20 minutes later, Decker stiffened slightly as the door to the facility opened, and Sebastian Leopold stepped out, dressed in the clothes he had walked in with, the orange prison jumpsuit and shackles stripped off him along with the murder charges. He looked around for a few moments, as though orienting himself to his surroundings. Then he turned right and started walking north. Decker waited about 20 seconds and then followed him, staying on the other side of the street. Paralleling the man, he kept his gaze forward, but his peripheral on Leopold. 15 minutes later, they had reached an area of Burlington that Decker knew well, seedy, disreputable, and known to harbor criminal elements with relish. A dive bar was on the right. Leopold walked down the short set of wobbly brick steps and went inside. Decker looked from side to side and then hustled across the street and down the same steps. He had been in this bar during a couple of stakeouts years ago and had come away empty each time. Maybe the third crack would be the charm. Leopold was seated at the center of the bar. The interior was dark and dreary. The lights turned down low. Decker knew this was primarily because everything in the place was filthy, and the owner probably thought that would be a turnoff to business. Decker doubted the patrons cared, though. When he had been here, they were mostly stoned on liquor, drugs, or both. He settled into a table at the back with a chest-high partition that he could see over, but that provided him with some cover. He was hard to miss, and even though he had only met Leopold once, he had to assume the man would remember him. He had seemed to recognize Decker in the courtroom. But that's not right. We've met twice, according to Leopold, when I dissed him at that 7-Eleven. So why can't I remember that when I can remember everything? Leopold ordered a drink, and when the bartender delivered it, he just stared at the glass for a long minute before raising it to his lips and taking a small sip before replacing it exactly in the same spot. He maneuvered the glass a bit, apparently to match the water ring on the bar. This did not escape Decker's notice. Possibly OCD. During his earlier meeting with the man, Decker had noted the constant movement of Leopold's hands. Was he really not all there? The PD said he was bipolar, but was now back on his meds. Maybe they could finally have a cogent conversation. A waitress came over to Decker. She was tall and thin, with a sea of bleached blonde hair all done up in curls that nearly covered her face. The smell of the chemically treated hair wafted over him, sweet and slightly nauseating. He ordered a beer, which she brought to him a minute later. He took a drink, wiped his mouth, and waited. There was no mirror behind the bar, so Leopold had no way to spot Decker behind him unless he turned around. 20 minutes passed, and no one had approached Leopold. The man had taken exactly 2 more sips of his drink and was staring down at it, as though he was unaware of how it had gotten there. Decker left $2 on his table, picked up his beer, walked up to the bar, and sat down next to him. Leopold didn't look over. He was still staring at his drink.
"Feel good to be out?" asked Decker.
"Celebrating?"
Leopold looked at him.
"You were in the courtroom. I saw you."
"I was also in your jail cell."
Leopold nodded, but the statement had not really seemed to register with him. He mumbled something Decker did not catch. Decker's gaze ran swiftly over the man. They had cleaned him up for his 2 court appearances, and his clothes had been laundered, probably because the cops couldn't stand the stink. Leopold said in a louder voice,
"In my jail cell."
"That's right.
We talked."
"Yes, we did."
"So you recanted?"
Leopold looked alarmed.
"I did what?"
"Took back your confession."
Leopold picked up his drink and took another sip.
I don't really drink, but this is good.
Celebrating, like I said.
What do I have to celebrate?
Leopold asked curiously. Not being charged with a triple homicide. Not being in jail. Both good things, wouldn't you say? Leopold shrugged.
They fed me. I had a bed.
Is that why you confessed to the murders? For a bed and 3 squares? Leopold shrugged again. So, you were in jail in Cranston on the night of the murders?
I guess I was. It was a long time ago. I don't remember. There are lots of things I don't remember.
Like your real name. Leopold glanced at him, but didn't really seem to register what Decker had said.
Well, the judge wouldn't have let you off if there was any doubt. It had to be your picture and prints on that arrest record. The lawyer was very happy, said Leopold, staring down at his drink.
How did you even know about the murders? Decker asked.
I killed those people, didn't I? Said Leopold, in a timid voice that carried with it not a trace of conviction, or even, it seemed, understanding.
The bartender, a man in his 50s with a gut nearly the size of Decker's, though he was 6 inches shorter, looked up from the glass he was wiping and stared at Leopold for a long moment before looking away.
That's not what you told the judge this morning. You said the opposite of that. Did your lawyer tell you to say that? He said I shouldn't talk about any of this with anybody.
Decker stared curiously at the man.
A glimmer of lucidity? Of self-preservation amid a sea of insanity? Is it the meds talking?
Well, then, I guess you shouldn't, unless you want to. But I don't see a problem for you. Cops have zip. You were in jail at the time. The judge dismissed the case without prejudice, but they can't recharge you unless they have some evidence tying you to the crime. Now, they may go and get some. Find an accomplice who did the killings for you for some reason. They may even make something up.
Can they do that?
Asked Leopold in childlike wonder.
Sure, they do it all the time. If they think you're a bad guy, they'll do anything to nail you, get you off the street. They're sworn to protect and defend. You can see that, right?
Leopold bent down and took another sip of his drink without lifting up the glass, like a dog lapping from its bowl.
So are you, Sebastian?
Am I what?
A bad guy. They need to get off the streets.
I don't know.
Decker felt his irritation start to rise. What had happened to his head might have rerouted his brain functions and caused other features to mentally intersect, but it had also robbed him of his ability to deal with bullshit, deceit, and generally squirrely behavior. He liked straight lines, A to B, 1 to 2. He did not like back and forth that got one nowhere except riled up. This had been both a blessing and a curse as a cop.
You said you killed those people. You told me you did.
Told the cops you did.
And this morning you said you didn't. But sitting here in this bar, you said you probably did, even though you were in jail 2 towns over and couldn't have even been at that house. So you can understand my confusion, can't you? And the cops? Where does the truth lie?
That's what we need to determine. Leopold turned to him and seemed to really see Decker for the first time.
Why do you care?
If Decker had dissed this guy at the 7-Eleven 17 months ago, Decker hadn't changed so much that Leopold wouldn't recognize him. He was just fatter and uglier now. So either the guy was innocent or the asshole was lying, and Decker had no clear indication of which answer was correct. I took an interest in the case. Never thought they'd arrest somebody after all this time.
It was a cold case.
The phrase caught Decker's attention.
You know about cold cases? I like the TV show. I watch it at the shelter sometimes.
Homeless shelter?
Leopold nodded. I'm homeless, so I gotta go somewhere. Sometimes I sleep outside. Most times I sleep outside, he added in a tired voice.
Why's that?
'Cause it's safer. There are guys in the shelter who want... nice.
Is that what got you interested in the murders here? Because it was a cold case?
I think so, yeah.
Why that case in particular, though? It's not the only cold case. Somebody talked to you about it?
Leopold was nodding. He looked down at his drink, took another sip without using his hands.
"What'd you order?" asked Decker, glancing at the glass, concealing his disgust with how the other man was drinking his liquor. Leopold smiled.
"Kamikaze. I like them."
"You said you didn't really drink."
"I don't because I never have any money. But I found a $5 bill I didn't know I had. When I do drink, I order kamikazes because I like them.
The drink I take it, and not the Japanese suicide pilots."
Leopold shrugged noncommittally.
"I wanted to be a pilot when I was a kid, but not one who crashes the plane on purpose." "No, not one like that."
"So you talked to somebody. They told you about the case. Maybe you got excited. So you decided to use it to get a warm bed and three squares. Is that what somebody told you you could get with a confession? Food and a bed?"
"Who would tell me that?"
Decker finished his beer and slammed the mug down on the bar with a sharp rap that made Leopold jump, which was what Decker wanted. He wanted this weaselly son of a bitch to